Welcome to the Guff, man. I'm Alex, and with me is James.
Hello.
Hey, James. Just before we get started, we want to implore you to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We have a lot of content up on there. James wrote something last week about the campaign that doesn't involve you needing to see the movie, just sort of about the careers of Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis and how they correspond weirdly with the presidencies of George Bush and Barack Obama. It's kind of interesting, and it's kind of funny, and it's definitely worth a read. We've also got a podcast on Chinatown right now, which is totally worth checking out, and I'll be putting out something on Thursday, probably about the Expendables and the action hero and where the action hero stands now. But yeah, and also make sure to follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men, all one word, MacGuffin spelled M-A-C. And yeah, and tell your friends about us. Retweet us, tweet us, post our stuff on Facebook, start a MySpace page for us, pretend it's 2004, like the movie we're going to be talking about today. And yeah, all right, let's just start the episode.
Okay.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. This week's episode is brought to you by Jeremy Renner, proving you can be a leading man in Hollywood with a face like that. And now, here are James and me. Welcome to the government. Again. Welcome for the second time in 2 minutes.
It's kind of like a sidequel to the podcast.
Nice. So what are we talking about here today, James?
The Bourne Legacy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bourne. You said Bourne, so I was sold. I didn't hear the second part, but Bourne's good enough.
Yeah. Bourne Legacy.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you like the Bourne movies, we have podcasts about the original ones.
Yeah.
And we are big fans of the first three.
Absolutely.
So we were excited about this one, no?
I don't know if you could call me excited. Very interested.
Okay. But yeah. A little apprehensive that it would be good?
Absolutely.
Okay, and now that you've seen it, how do you feel?
I really liked it.
Yeah?
A lot.
Good.
I think it's like the third most fun Bourne movie to watch, but it's probably the second most fun to think about, which is cool. And here's how I was sort of like talking to myself, because on our minisode last week, I mentioned how worried I was about it. It's just sort of like this bad feeling came over me. And then I sort of started to think about that like the day before I was going to see it. I was like, okay, so the trailer, the thing that gets me excited about the trailer is when they say that Jason Bourne is in New York, that line. And I was like, that's the line that they've put in it to sell the people that are kind of unsure about whether or not Jason Bourne is going to be in this movie. I know he's not going to be in the movie, so that's not in there for me. So that's probably not going to matter very much to the movie. Turns out I was right. It matters kind of, but it's not the crux of the movie at all. So I was like, okay, talk myself.
And so that line is just in there for people who like the first one, but hope this isn't turning into a franchise where this fourth one is going to be too distant from the first three.
Yeah, I think so. Like, it's certainly there to, you know, place it. Why is it Bourne, called Bourne without Jason Bourne, you know?
Yeah.
And the other thing that, you know, my expectations were really, I was really worried about, I was sort of like, okay, the Bourne Ultimatum is probably the best action movie ever made. At worst, you know, it has my favorite fight sequence in it. It has, at worst, my second favorite car chase. And the one that beats that in the car chase is in the Bourne movie before it. I was like, Greengrass isn't doing this movie. Just accept that the action probably won't be great, and just hope for the best. Hope that Tony Gilroy did more Michael Clayton-y things than he did Duplicity things. And for the most part, he did. So I really liked it.
I didn't get the Duplicity vibe a lot.
In that it didn't suck?
Yeah.
Did you like it?
Yeah, I did.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I loved it.
Okay.
But I liked it. And
there are certainly, there are big problems with this movie. Mostly tonally, like it's just the way the movie was put together is sort of really inconsistent style. I don't know, some scenes don't look like the color scheme is the same as the rest of the movie. I don't know this is a real problem in the first half more than the second, but.
Okay. How did Jeremy Renner do for you?
I liked him. Okay. I liked him. I thought he
was... You sound so reserved saying that.
Yeah, I liked him. I mean, we've both been vocal about neither of us really loves Jeremy Renner or has seen him in anything we love him in. The Hurt Locker is probably his most notable performance, which I just didn't particularly love him in. But I mean, he's got sort of the "a child died in front of me, so now I get to scream" type thing going for that performance. Whereas this, you know, he was just quality spy, generally likable, made me laugh once, maybe twice. And, you know, I totally bought him as like a manly guy who could fight people. So he did his job.
That's good. Huh. Yeah, well, this is his first kind of big action-y, like, starring role, right, since then?
Yes, yes.
Unless there's something I'm forgetting, but if so, I probably didn't see
Certainly
it.
Certainly nothing in, like, with the, you know, the way, certainly nothing on the level of the Hurt Locker since then that he's been the lead in. Like, yeah. The Town he was a supporting in, same with Avengers, Mission Impossible 4, you know.
So. Right.
This is the Renner a leading man movie, basically.
Yeah. Good for him.
Congrats, Jer. Did you like him?
Did you
like him?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, he fit in. I mean, it's because he's kind of supposed to be like Jason Bourne again, but mm-hmm. still not. Like, he's gone through the same program and system and everything, so he's supposed to have.
He's gone through a different program.
A different program, but I mean, a very mentally altering program.
Yeah, yeah.
That, you know, it's supposed to distance you from other people. That's one of their stated goals. So, yep. You know, he still has to kind of hit a lot of the same notes. So I was worried that it might be a little just redundant because, you know, it's a very similar kind of feel. But yeah. I didn't think he was too Matt Damon-y.
No, I thought like that. I thought they did a really good job of changing, like, making Aaron Cross a character that definitely stands apart from Jason Bourne, you know?
Yeah, even though a lot of the things about his story are the same.
Yeah.
He just doesn't have the, as much of the I'm lost and I don't know what I'm doing kind of thing.
Yeah, mostly because he has a memory, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, he even without the amnesia, there still is a little bit of that to him.
Yeah.
You know, not knowing where he, like, what he's doing or, you know, when he at the start, when he's up in Alaska,
yeah,
they don't know what they're doing or where they're really headed and things like that. I mean, there still is a very strong sense of being lost and trying to put things together as they come up. But
yeah,
that's kind of a spy movie trope, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. How about Rachel? How much time do we need to allot for you to talk about Rachel Weisz?
You know, not that much. I really liked her in this movie, though. Yeah. Like, I like Rachel Weisz in general. I think she is occasionally a really great actress who is generally overrated. Like, the movies that she gets the most love for, she's not at her best in. Like, I think she's, like, stellar in The Fountain, and I think she's really great here. Specifically, the scene where she's getting interrogated, I thought she was awesome in that scene. Just the way she's, like, folding laundry and putting, you know, empty bottles away and just...
The one at her house?
Yeah.
That might be one of my favorite scenes in this whole movie.
Oh, it's a great scene.
Because
everything that happens at that house is awesome.
Yeah, so Aaron Cross's ninja arrival is a little much, maybe, but I guess that's kind of
the deal. No, the thing that I thought so funny is that, like, why does he wait that long to come out of that that closet? Like, they, you know, they sort of start holding her down, and then they're counting to three, and it's like Aaron is like, oh, they're counting to three for me, and then I'll jump, you know? Because it's not like...
You're going to count to three? I've got at least 2 seconds to chill in here.
He comes out of a stationary place. It's not like he's running it down the hallway. It just happens to time it right.
Well, yeah, I wasn't sure about that. And did they not have anybody outside? Or
it was they do.
But it's that guy who's really far away who...
It's those...
Stuck by.
Those two people with the SUV at the front of the house.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I really liked that scene. Yeah, she was really good in that. And... As stupid as I feel saying it now, I didn't see it coming that the woman was just going to start kicking ass.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was effective.
Yeah.
That was good. And just kind of shows you the depth. I mean, that's what I kind of love spy movies and the Bourne movies especially, is when you see how good these people are at their jobs and playing all the different characters and stuff that they need to play to get information from people. And that was one scene that I thought really was great for that.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean... the way they used the house in that movie for that action scene was so cool, I thought.
Like, oh yeah, him going up and down, like up yeah. outside and then down through the holes and
like
stuff.
He uses the whole house, and I just thought like that was so cool, and the way they laid it out was really, really well done, and just how he gets away from the first guy, then uses the fire extinguisher on him, and then, you know, beats the crap out of him, and then turns on that saw, and then goes up to get the girl before she gets to Rachel Weisz, and yeah. then goes back, and then gets Rachel Weisz to shoot a gun, and then he shoots her, the other guy. Like, that whole sequence was so cool.
Yeah.
Like, that was awesome. That was one of the coolest sequences I've seen in a long time, I think.
Yeah, and we see Jason Bourne in the first three, like in the Dash Tangier scene we were talking about. Like, they do go big and have him, you know, deal with geography and that those kinds of ways. But this one was like much more of a set piece. Like, yeah. it's just a house.
Yeah.
And let's go like 360 up, down, whatever. Yeah, but it was just a nice, like, little set piece that, yeah, I thought was probably one of the best parts of the whole movie.
Oh, yeah, definitely. As far as action, it was definitely the best part.
Yeah, and you mentioned the fire extinguisher, and this is one gripe I do have with this movie, is that was kind of the only little bit of, unless I'm forgetting something, and point it out if I am, mm-hmm. but there's usually like a cool little MacGyver-y moment in every Jason Bourne movie.
Okay.
And the fire extinguisher seemed to be the only one, and they used it in the trailer, so I was kind of sad.
Well, I mean, yeah, this trailer was, they had to sell it. Hard, like they use a lot of the last action sequence in the trailer as well. Like they were unsure people were going to show up for this movie. They, you know, they also moved the date out of fear of going up against Total Recall and Batman's third weekend.
Gotta watch out for that Total Recall, right?
Let's not talk about Total Recall. I saw it and I hated it.
Okay. Hey, we did. We talked about it. Moving on.
Anyway, the fan, you know, attaching the flashlight to the fan and ultimatum, that yeah, type of thing
the,
you think of?
The, yeah, and the gas line and the magazine and the toaster.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
And maybe I'm just, like, and I wasn't up on the Bourne trilogy as it was coming out, so maybe I just forget that stuff in the trailer.
Yeah.
But I feel like...
The fan and flashlight definitely wasn't. I feel like... You know, well, we definitely would have seen him use the newspaper.
You would see the explosion. I don't know if you see the newspaper.
The explosion is definitely in the Supremacy trailer, but him setting it up is not.
Yeah, yeah, and so I don't know. Like, I always love this, and when we talked about this in The Conversation and all any kind of remotely spy movie, I always love those, and the like the Watch Under the Tire in Chinatown.
Yeah.
I always love those just very physical, like, real, tangible, cool little tricks.
See, but I thought, like, that whole house sequence, I thought that's what that was to me. You know, it was just like the house was the thing he was MacGyvering, you know? Like,
yeah, no, I know what you mean. It wasn't MacGyvering enough, though. Like, I understand that it's, you know, that physical aspect of it, but yeah,
I don't know, man. I gotta disagree with you on this one.
That's too hard for me to do. I can do all the other things.
Okay.
I can't beat four people up in a house, but I can blow that house up with some natural gas and a toaster.
Okay, fair.
And I want to.
Fair.
I've said too much.
Luckily, nobody listens to this, so it won't be used against you in the court of law.
Yeah.
We're the podcast versions of rappers right now, bragging about our crimes to come.
What about Edward Norton?
I liked him.
Do you have more to say about Rachel Weisz?
No, I just thought, Rachel Weisz was really great. You know, there were parts where she wasn't as good, and, you know, like on the airplane, she looked way too scared or something, or not on the airplane, but like waiting. She looked very childish, and, you know, it wasn't as great, but I thought her interrogation scene, she was really great. I loved her in the scene, the lab massacre. I thought that was a great scene as well. Totally different scene from anything we've seen in the Bourne movies, I think, as well. And just the way tension built was really, really great. And I thought she was really good and adequately terrified in that scene. And the interrogation was good. And in general, I thought she was really good. And I mean, I like her a lot. I've said that already. So, but Edward Norton, I also enjoyed. He had sort of like a role that Edward Norton can do in his sleep, though.
Yeah. So. Well, I thought he fit in perfectly to the whole Bourne quadrilogy.
Oh, he absolutely did. When I saw, I remember when he was like cast, I was like, I wonder if he's going to be like the Pam Landy type. And he was. And, you know,
he's a little bit less likable, though.
He's more of, yeah, I suppose he's more of the Chris Cooper. He's more of a company man. But he was really, really good. And the line, I think the hardest I laughed in the movie was when they're talking about larks and Stacy Keach's character is like, what? Nobody informed me that this was happening. And Edward Norton's like, consider yourself informed, it's happening, or whatever he said. Just so funny.
Yeah. And just like, there's certain dialogue that is just so boring to me.
Yeah.
And when you do it perfectly, I'm just glad you're in it. Like, yeah, it was totally used a lot in the trailer, but all the, what is it? Like the collateral if this moves sideways on us or whatever that whole speech was. Yeah. It's just, yeah, that could be in any of the Bourne movies and fit in just perfectly.
Yep.
And yeah, I thought he nailed it. So he gets a complete check mark for
me. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I was very pleased with him. And we got Noah Bosum. We got some pictures of Pam Landy.
We get some Pam Landy at the end.
Oh, yeah, we do get moving Pam Landy a little bit.
Yeah.
You see a very young picture of Pam Landy, too.
I know. I was like, did they get that from Face Off? I was very confused. Yeah. Because the hair was similar, too, and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, was this separate enough from the other three, or was it, like, it's that weird side cool thing. So we're looking at it all within the narrative of the first one. Like, it starts after the Bourne trilogy starts and ends before they start. Would that be right?
No, it ends after the Bourne ultimatum ends. Because at the end, like that thing with Pam Landy, we don't see that hearing in the Bourne ultimatum.
Oh, right.
That's the thing, like after she fought, and Hirsch dies in this movie. Like it's said that he dies, who is Albert Finney's character in Ultimatum.
Yeah.
He dies in this movie, like not on screen, but it's mentioned. And he's very much alive at the end of Ultimatum. He probably does get that star on the wall at Langley, given how he dies. But
No, you're right. Those scenes with Pam are all about the repercussions of the last thing she does in the trilogy.
Yeah, I think the second half of this movie happens after Ultimatum ends. And I think that's where I like the second half of this movie better than I like the first half, because I think the movie did struggle a bit to integrate Bourne. Maybe it's just because I know the movies better than most people. Like, it pandered to people that weren't me. And I don't mean that as a pejorative. I just mean it sort of as, I've seen the Bourne Ultimatum more times than you. Like, that's just a fact, you know? Unless you've seen it 20 times, I've seen it more than you.
A majority of people on this planet, I have seen those movies more than
exactly.
you.
Exactly.
Empirically speaking.
And, yeah, and so, I mean, that was the part that wasn't for necessarily aimed at me. Like, when they cut to Simon Ross, they could have just mentioned that thing happening and I would have instantly known what it was. You know, the only thing that they really added in was that thing I mentioned from the trailer, that the thing they added in that I really liked from Ultimatum was that Noah Bosum scene as Bourne gets to New York, that guy going off to the side and calling Edward Norton. I guess we can call that guy the bald Danny Zorn guy, because he's Danny Zorn to Noah Bosum, I guess.
Yep.
But anyway, and him calling Edward Norton, I thought was a really cool touch. Not just to tell Jason Bourne, not just because, you know, Jason Bourne's in New York and now we're, you know, linking these two movies, but because Edward Norton and him have some sort of history. I thought that was super cool.
Yeah, and it does fit it in together in such a way that it's not inconsistent with the first one at all.
Yeah. And
but
yeah,
still builds on it. Yeah, yeah.
Just in general, like, I thought this movie, again, like, removing those parts that I felt were sort of pandering to the audience that wasn't me, I thought this movie in general was pretty much done as well as you can do, given that you have to tie it into a pre-existing franchise and a franchise that works almost perfectly as a three-movie thing, as far as, closure and
weird,
all that.
Yeah, it's a weird set of goals that, like, it has to accomplish a lot of things that most action movies don't need to address.
Yeah. This might be a totally unique movie. I can't think of another example where this has happened. You know, like, we've talked about the Marvel Universe on here, but that's different because, it's just sort of linking, like, they had a plan, you know. The Bourne movies have gone one by one. Bourne Identity, there was no guarantee there was going to be a sequel. Bourne Supremacy was written as the end of the series, and then Ultimatum was just so good and definitely the end of a series, you know?
Yeah.
And then they had to add to that. And just and even as far as the visuals go, again, I mentioned some inconsistencies, but that could just be because of all the white that was in Alaska. And there's generally just not a lot of snow in the Bourne movies, except for, I guess, those, the Russia scenes and Supremacy and Ultimatum. But even Supremacy and Ultimatum had a lot more close-ups than this movie did. But anyway, just the camera, it wasn't super handheld. Like, it wasn't handheld and quick cut all the time. It was pretty much all handheld work with, you know, some stationary establishing shots and stuff like that. But it was sort of, it wasn't a slave to the style, but it also used elements of it. And I thought that was cool.
Yeah, and I think,
because I don't think anybody can do handheld like Paul Greengrass can, or his team.
Yeah, and I think I think that kind of might have worked to their advantage, because I know you and I like it, but I think that most people, that is one of their problems with the trilogy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this way they are not trying to outdo someone who's very good at it, but still kind of continuing it.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, they're certainly not going to go to the extent that he did, but there's a bit of it, and it cuts down on it, which is great for the people who don't like it, but you put enough in that it stays kind of visually consistent with
yeah the yeah like just in general, the everything was shot handheld but with way less close-ups. Like in the fight scenes, there were a lot more wide shots and stuff like that, whereas you almost never got a wide shot in Bourne Supremacy and Ultimatum fight scenes. And I mean, Bourne Identity was very much more a stereotypical, as far as the camera work, there's not a lot of handheld in Bourne Identity. It's just sort of in the fight scenes.
Yeah, well, just to go back to one thing you said about this being kind of a unique movie in the way that it ties into another trilogy without just being a direct, you know, sequel to the third.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like, are they trying to turn this kind of into a Bond thing? But with the caveat that Bond usually exists in either a straight line, like one after the other, after the other, after the other, or in some weird space-time vacuum where things just aren't addressed. And now the Bond looks different, but we won't talk about it. And it's kind of a little different what they're doing with the Daniel Craig ones, which is seems like almost a complete reboot a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But the other ones are just, you know, it's just never talked about. Why, you know, sometimes things will be referenced from another movie,
yeah,
but sometimes they're pretty self-contained.
Yeah, I don't think there's a master plan for Bourne.
And it kind of seems like there never was.
No, exactly. And I mean, Tony Gilroy, obviously, I mean, it makes sense for him to keep mum on this anyways, but Tony Gilroy says there's no grand plan. It's just sort of like, we'll see what happens with Legacy. And I mean, if Bourne 4 had been a possibility, you know, like a straight Bourne 4 with Jason Bourne, as opposed to Aaron Cross, if had Paul Greengrass been like, okay, I'll do this, and then Matt Damon would have jumped on, because Matt Damon has been very open, like, I would love to do this again, but Paul Greengrass has to be the director.
Yeah.
So, like, had that been a possibility, like, in 2009, Greengrass and Damon were like, yep, let's do it, then that would have happened, you know? So it's not like this was ever part of the plan. And I mean, they left it open in a way that I think the studio would be happiest if Matt Damon would come back, for sure. And they've made it so that they can easily work these two characters together, or they can leave Jeremy Renner off to the side and just bring back Bourne. Either way works, honestly.
Yeah. Or even, and this is probably the least likely of the three, but just get another guy.
Yeah. Well, I think they would stick with Renner, also because there's a lot of stuff with Cross in this movie that really leaves open for a sequel, I think, and which, I mean, obviously was smart and probably necessary as far as the studio's concerned. I really think that scenario is unlikely. I mean, I know you said it is, but it's either Bourne and Renner, or just Renner, or just Bourne.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's, my money is honestly on both of them coming back for 5, but
okay.
What do I know? Mm-hmm. I think it was Greengrass. Did you hear what his title for the fourth Bourne movie? They were joking about it.
The Bourne.
Right after. Yeah.
The Bourne Redundancy.
Yeah.
Which is funny.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. That was like his line in interviews when he was saying, "No, I'm not going to do number four."
Yeah, I have one joke and 1,000 press junkets.
Line up, fellas.
I can be very redundant with my born redundancy jokes. Yeah. So why the wait? Just to get everything in order? Just because it's.
Wait,
your understanding of it that Matt Damon kind of wanted to, and then Greengrass said no, and that kind of ate up some time, and this is kind of what they figured out.
There was also the where do we go? Like, even with Bourne, it's not like there was a cut and dry direction of where to go with Bourne, just again because of how well tied up everything in Ultimatum is. And I mean, they loosen those ends up in Legacy with all the stuff with Pamela Landia and Noah Vosen. You know, they reopen those cases and Killing Hirsch as well, which is heavily implied as an inside job. But yeah, no, it's just sort of, I think it was just sort of, we don't see a definite way to keep going. And it was sort of like, I think Greengrass and Damon were still sort of like bouncing it around, you know, like they were sort of trying to think of a new idea, like the way to keep it going. But and I think that would be why they would explain a good portion of the wait. Obviously, like, I think this movie was starting, let's say this movie starts production in 2009, like from the very base stages of having Tony Gilroy visit the Ludlum estate and try and spitball ideas. So I think it's totally reasonable to believe that Universal would have given Greengrass and Damon till 2009 to, you know, definitively say, no, we don't have anything.
Yeah.
Do what you will.
Get them if you can, but.
Yeah, exactly. It's like had Christopher Nolan left open, you know, maybe I'll come back for Batman 4 if I can think of an idea. You know, they would
give him a long time.
Exactly.
Yeah. As much as they want to make another one.
And particularly since the way the Bourne grosses grew with each movie, somewhat surprisingly, I think it was just sort of like, I don't know, the audience really came around on the Bourne franchise, whereas a lot of franchises, it's, you don't get a much bigger audience than you do initially.
Yeah, and a lot of them shrink.
Pardon?
And a lot of them just shrink.
Yeah, exactly.
The audiences.
Yeah, and I mean, the Bourne franchise in general is one that plays to older audiences quicker. So, I mean, the video market really helped grow those grosses.
Yeah. So do you think the wait made this better or worse?
For me, better. I'm happy there was distance. Because it's sort of, I was able to come to terms with the Bourne trilogy being ended as a full story, and then also had time to come to terms with, no, that's not true. You know, like, I'm happy with 5 years, because then I do see this as a new franchise. It's like tied to the old franchise, but none of the things that this movie changes about Ultimatum hurt the Bourne Ultimatum to me at all.
So this is your Phantom Menace.
No, because I think I would have to hate it, wouldn't I?
Yeah, you would.
Yeah.
I was just hoping Jake Lloyd would be in this. No, I am not.
Yeah.
Did you find it, like, a lot of the reviews I was reading said this movie is probably good, but just compared to the other three, it's not. And that's not to say the consensus on this is that it's a bad movie, but that's some of the reviews I've been reading, in that it's a good action movie, but what we come to expect from the Bourne movies and what we've already seen in it, it's kind of just treading water. Like, if this replaced one of the Bourne movies, one of the original trilogy, it would probably be good. But having seen everything we've seen in three, and, like, did you feel that this was maybe just those three movies repackaged a little 5 years later?
No.
Or does it, no?
No.
Like, what's new for you in this, then? Chems?
Yeah. That's a big part of it. That's what the whole movie is. And I thought it was really interesting. Like, it wasn't about the government anymore. It was about pharmaceutical companies. And I thought that was really cool. Because, like, throughout the movie, we see, you know, Aaron Cross needs his chems, right? And the chems are pills, you know? So it's basically a placement for medicine, you know? I think, and they call it chems because, they call it chems because chemicals is a more pejorative term than medicine. Whereas medicine always sounds positive to the average person, chemicals just sounds it sounds like a negative, even though, you know, medicine is chemicals, know? And so, you know, it's just sort of the search for, he needs to get off these medicine, this medicine, these chemicals, and sort of the government is sort of in place of a, like a big pharmaceutical company where it's sort of like, we're going to keep giving you these pills, and you have to keep taking them. Like, you are sort of going to rely on them. Otherwise, your quality of life is going to go significantly down. And you're either going to keep taking these pills for the rest of your life or until we decide to kill you. You know, and it's just sort of like, I don't know, it's just the way Cross is attached to his chems, his meds, is just sort of, I don't know, I think it's supposed to be like a real tie-in with pharmaceutical companies and the way that, you know, they don't call him Aaron Cross, they call him Five. You know, they don't see people taking their product as people, they see them as numbers. And it's just sort of, you know, the government in this movie, you know, is using these chems to sort of get control, like theoretically to use these agents to pull off tasks that would give the government of the United States more control over their enemies, as opposed to, like, you know, which sort of stands in for pharmaceutical companies just sort of using these people to get more money, like seeing them as a number to get the company money, you know what I mean? So it's less literal than the other movies were, but Bourne Ultimatum was the only one that was super interesting like that, which is why I say Bourne Legacy, I think, is my second favorite one to think about. And and I mean, the end of the movie we see, which I thought was so clever, one, that they keep the chems in the dog tag, which is a nice tie-in to the Bourne movies, and also sort of like keeps them, like, it's you and these chems, like, you are together. Dog tag, you know, is typically like a name tag for people that die. This is with you until you die. And that's sort of what the chems are as well. And when he hangs up his dog tag with, well, I mean, with no more chems in it because he's off them, Rachel Weisz's character is able to
viral off.
Yeah, viral him off so that he doesn't need them anymore. He's still got the benefits of him, which is I know where my theory gets a little sketchier. But anyways, he puts them up, and it's just sort of like, and writes no more on the mirror. And they were so much a part of him, you know, that they're in his dog tags. They were a part of his name. They were a part of him. And it's
the dog tag is kind of the only individual, you know, the thing that identifies you as this individual in the, you know, classic military uniform, right?
Exactly.
So for this to be so close to his identity and his, you know, his very individuality, I see what you mean.
Yeah. And also, I mean, the movie, one thing about this movie that I didn't love is how quickly this Lark's agent is used and disposed of. But the idea is that that's a program further up. Like, Aaron Cross is further up than Jason Bourne. Lark's 3 is a bit higher up than Aaron Cross. And I would imagine, well, the way they talk about it is that there's more chemicals in Lark's 3 than there ever was in Aaron Cross. And he's more, like, numb emotionally than Aaron Cross. Like, Aaron Cross, we get a lot of definable human characteristics, and he seems like a decent person, like a good person. Whereas Lark's 3, and I mean, this is really summed up in the way, well, the motorcycle scene, how Aaron Cross avoids people and sort of like grinds the rail down in the motorcycle, whereas Lark's 3 literally runs people over.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like, he's just numb emotionally. And I think the idea that the movie's trying to get across is it's these chems that have been given to him that have numbed him emotionally. Whereas Aaron Cross isn't all the way off the deep end, but Lark's is. Lark's 3 is.
Yeah. And it's typical of the Bourne franchise where sometimes it's these quick lines or like a quick phrases that just come at you while they're, and it's right in the middle of all their, you know, government and military, or in this case pharmaceutical jargon. But it just says really quickly when explaining the Lark's 3 program that it's reduced empathy was one of their main goals.
Yeah, exactly. No, I definitely remember that.
Yeah. And it's just quick, it's just two words and it goes by. And, you know, I know I'm not the only person who noticed it, but yeah, stuff like that. And to tie it into the pharmaceutical thing, I mean, a big complaint about people taking too many pharmaceuticals or doctors overprescribing them is, I think, the go-to thing is that it just makes you numb. Like, it stops you from experiencing bad things and good things, and it just numbs you.
Yeah, exactly. And
that's exactly what they get at with Lark's 3.
Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that, and I mean, I said I don't like how quickly Larks 3 is disposed of, but I love the way he is disposed of, because Rachel Weisz's character, who I keep calling Rachel Weisz because I forget her name, but she is the one that kills him, and I think that's so cool. And it's sort of like, you know, Aaron Cross can only do so much, you know, like, we need your help, doctors, you know, like, you need to take a you need to take a stand and stop this. And that's what Rachel Weisz's character does. She stops Larks, you know. And yeah. By the way, that crash is awesome. I literally said oh shit out loud when I saw that. I thought that was so sweet. But yeah, that the last bit of action comes down to the doctor character, I thought it was really cool. And the person that has been making the meds, I mean, we see like this very, we see a clearer arc with Rachel Weisz's character in this movie than we do with Aaron Cross, which I thought was really interesting and further adds to the list of strong females in the Bourne series, which I've always really liked. Yeah. You know, sort of growing, like, I mean, I put Pam Landy and Rachel Weisz's character on the same level as far as how tough they are and how awesome they are, you know, how little shit they'll take. Whereas, you know, Marie's just a little bit lower down, but she was still kind of tough. Yeah, just in general, the way she disposes of Larks, I thought was really cool.
Yeah.
So, for that reason. Rarely.
Her too, Julia Stiles.
Yeah, she's not tough. That tough, though.
Not that tough. Yeah. It was tough for her.
Nice.
With him.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. One, I want to get back to the females, especially Rachel Weisz.
Sorry, did I derail all of your thoughts with my conspiracy theories?
No.
Alex Jones is leaving the room.
It's about the pharmaceutical companies, and yeah, it's something we didn't see in the first one. I mean, the first three.
Yeah,
really. I mean, we have indications that there is some personality altering going on, but it certainly never gets as explicit as this one. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, implies all the like literally the name of the chemical companies and things like that. Mm-hmm. But are we supposed to see the pharmaceutical companies as the villain? Because Rachel Weisz, we clearly aren't supposed to be against.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, oh, you know, she's just following orders. And where are the villains in the pharmaceutical company? I mean, there's that guy who shoots up everything and then kills himself, but we're supposed to understand that he was victimized by, like, he was supposed to be brainwashed, no?
Well, I think the implication is that they are run by the government, right? That's sort of how I took it, is that that company that makes those chems and that does all this research, it's a government-run company. And that it's just sort of like the higher ups, like the, again, like Edward Norton and those people, Stacey Keach, those are the villains.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't know if, cause we don't see kind of a private.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's what I was saying. Whereas, this movie is more, less literal than Bourne Ultimatum was, where it was like really obviously like an administration of a government organization standing in for the administration of a government organization, you know? Whereas is an administration of a government organization standing in for a corporate entity, I guess.
Yeah, and I might be forgetting something, but there's just not that scene where we see the person at the top of this pharmaceutical company in cahoots with the government who, you know, we don't get any of, oh, I don't care what happens to them, money, 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 you know what
That's
I mean?
True. Like,
And I'm, you know, it's, I'm not saying this movie had to do that, and by not doing it, that they failed in some way. But I think it is a good criticism, and I think it is something that increasingly timely is, you know, the way people rely on prescription pills and, you know, just pharmaceuticals in general.
Yeah.
And kind of over medicating and things like that.
Yep.
Maybe it could have been a bit sharper, but
I agree with that, and I know the jumps I'm making are large, given that, like you said, we don't see a link to this in the movie. I'm just sort of doing this with my brain, and it's again purely metaphorical, other than the fact that, you know, there are pills being made in this movie and then consumed by
and
here.
You see the effects of it.
So
speaking of Rachel Weisz and all the other ladies we mentioned,
What
do you make of what appears to be a lack of romance between the two of them? They certainly seem to get along, and by the end of the movie, you know, it wouldn't be shocking that they had made out by that point.
Yeah.
but we don't see it on screen. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see them hug a little bit, but it seems that seemed to be more of like, you're a human being who's sick and maybe dying, and I'm helping you along.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're pretty busy to be getting busy, you know? Like, they've got a lot of stuff to do.
He found time in all the other ones.
Yeah, no, I know. All the other ones, I think it's just the first one. He's on the second Marie dies, that trilogy changes very quickly. It just sort of turns into, all right, I'm going. There's no time for banging anymore.
They're still
just busting heads.
There's still a couple at the start of the second one, I guess.
Yeah, for maybe 8 minutes before Carl Urban kills her, you know. But that's also he had gotten away from the CIA, basically. Anyways, doesn't matter. But yeah, no, it's just sort of like, I like that they didn't make out, mostly because I always like it when a male and female don't make out in a movie, because it's always expected. And
yeah.
When anything unexpected happens in a movie, I like it. So, but I did like, as the movie ended, I was like, man, what a bummer for Renner. He didn't get to make out with Rachel Weisz. Because if I saw like the Bourne Legacy script come across my desk, if I was Renner, and it's
who's
like,
the female? Who's the female?
Yeah,
lead?
Exactly. It's Rachel Weisz. Sign me up.
You get to take your shirt off and kind of rub up against her at a point.
Yeah. And there's like, there's no sexualizing of Rachel Weisz's character either. I thought it was really interesting.
No, not like, yeah, it's pretty,
we see her in a tank top and that's about it. And that's for like, I don't know, one half a scene.
Yeah. And we heard that she broke up with someone 8 months ago.
Yep.
That's pretty hot.
She does have really foxy bangs though. She's got that.
Yeah, for a little bit. What did you say? You had to mention something about her jeans.
Oh, she's just wearing incredible jeans in the interrogation scene. They just work for her very, very well.
Incredible that you want them, just incredible that.
No, I certainly don't want them. I want what's inside of them.
Pockets?
Yeah, exactly. Didn't you see? She put like this really fancy new iPhone in her pocket. So. Yeah.
Good times.
Yeah. How was the audience when you saw this movie? Like, what was the general makeup of it?
I don't know. Pretty across the spectrum from like teenagers to middle-aged people.
Okay.
With some senior citizens in there.
I was just curious because I always forget marketed and how well-liked the series is by people older than us, and often significantly older than us. This is sort of like the action franchise that parents get, or like our parents' age people get excited for. Because when I went to see it, it was a Friday afternoon, like a 3 o'clock show, so it's not out of the realm of possibility for, well, I mean, it's kind of silly. But anyways, I saw like a 3 o'clock show on a Friday afternoon, and it was just me and a bunch of middle-aged people. And I started to think about the actual franchise. One, this movie, I think, takes place in 2004, if I'm following the lineage of the series correctly, or at least like 2003, 2004, something around there, because that's when The Bourne Supremacy comes out, and Bourne Ultimatum takes place,
let's not get into that.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, at the most, The Bourne Ultimatum ends, like, 3 months later, and this is happening at
the
same
time. I'll need more blues if we're going to do all this over again.
Pardon?
I'll need more blues if we're going
to
do all this.
But no, so this movie's taking place in 2004, like maybe 2005 at the latest. And it's just sort of, it's this franchise where you could still get away with not having copious amounts of CGI and making tons of money, or having like a costume superhero. And Tony Gilroy, the writer and director of The Bourne Legacy, who did writing on each of the previous Bourne movies, but less so on Ultimatum, has said like he's just sort of, he's tired. He thinks that sort of like a watering down of masculinity has happened with the way like CGI and green screens and superheroes have sort of like taken away men heroes, and Bourne is kind of like the last franchise where you're able to do this. And I'm just sort of wondering, like, is there even the chance that you could get a franchise like this off the ground after 2005, let alone that it still exists in that time, you know?
Yeah, no, it'll be interesting if that does. I mean, there's always going to be action movies, and there's going to be non-superhero action movies, but as far as establishing a franchise...
And a summer franchise. That's the big thing.
It will be interesting if in 20 years we look back and this was a big trilogy that was financially successful, mm-hmm. kind of against the odds, I mean,
oh,
I
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, like, I don't think it was expected to do this well. And as you said before, it was never expected to keep going like
yeah,
this.
Yeah, every time it did well, it was surprising. Like, even the Bourne Ultimatum, I remember... I was super excited about that movie, of course. And then seeing it grossed like $69 million in its opening weekend, I was like floored. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, but no, and it'll be interesting to look back and see this kind of come in under the wire like that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, before these kinds of things stopped, but it was clearly on, you know, on the downslope. Mm-hmm. And what'll be very interesting is if narratively it stays in the mid 2000s.
Yeah.
Like if they never get out of that time period, it will be, you know, it'll kind of be an interesting, you know, they wouldn't be able to lean on it too hard in the movie, but this kind of interesting statement about how things have changed in cinema since then.
Yeah.
And they're kind of holding on to this time that may be gone. And yeah, it's that will be cool to see how that actually works out.
Absolutely. Yeah. And another thing that they kept, like, again, just going back to the, I mean, really quickly about the pharmaceutical thing, is that the Bourne movies have always been about truth. Like, Jason Bourne was trying to find out the truth about himself, and then he's sort of trying to find out the truth about what people did to him, and then he's supposed to trying to find out the, or trying to provide the people with the truth about what happened. And then this movie is sort of, you know, the same thing, but about a different thing with chems. And I thought what was interesting about the Pam Landy scene at the end, when she basically has had her ideas, or what she tried to do at the end of the Bourne Ultimatum, is sort of like, nope, didn't work, suck it. You know, like the Noah Vosum pretty much wins at the end of this movie. But Pam Landy's sort of... her exit interview, like when she's getting into that car, sort of like, do you regret taking a stand? And what she's saying is basically, no, not at all. Like, I know I lost, but the truth is always worth fighting for. And I think that's really interesting. A really interesting thing about these Bourne movies is that, you know, you're going to lose more often than you win, but the fight is still worth it. And I think that's really cool. And I really like that. And I don't know. It's sort of like this big, vague thing that the movie's about, or that the series is about. But yeah, it's something I guess I like philosophically and just in general enjoy in my films.
Yeah, no, and it's one of those ones, and I find this in a lot of movies. It seems kind of broad, you know? It's like, yeah, truth is good, but sometimes it's tough. Like, it's,
yeah,
you know, it seems very pedestrian, but... when, especially over four movies, when you see it get played with in all these different ways and looked at from different angles, it is good to have a big theme like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just gets explored in a lot of different ways, and it's interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
It is. I don't know. It was kind of sad to see Pam lose like that, though, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's sad, like, to see anybody you care about lose.
I know, point. But it just kind of it's. I mean, those movies stand on them on their own, but I feel like watching them again, it's going to have like her whole statement, her in that entire ending where she's running away from Vosum to try to get things faxed out just in time. Like, it'll seem kind of neutered, you know?
Yeah. Well, if anything, it makes it more realistic.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And makes Pam the lovable loser even more so.
How dare you? Don't ever call Pam a loser. She might have lost, but she's not a loser.
Okay. I'll give you that.
Yeah. And for those of you wondering if the Bourne Legacy ended using Moby's Extreme Ways like the rest of the franchise, which is a question I was actually asked multiple times on the weekend, we're not going to spoil that for you. You're just going to have to wait and find out.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.